Today's episode of the Accidental Creative Podcast is brought to you by FreshBooks. To see how FreshBooks can save you time and boost your creativity, go to freshbooks.com/accidental and enter accidental in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Hey everyone, welcome to the Accidental Creative Podcast. My name is Todd Henry. I am the founder of Accidental Creative and the author of several books, including The Accidental Creative, Die Empty, Louder Than Words, and the new book, Herding Tigers, which is about how to create an environment in which creative teams thrive. Here on the show, we talk about you and your process and how to be prolific, brilliant, and healthy all at the same time in life and work so that you can produce the best work of your life. On today's show, we're going to talk about the importance of creativity, but not just creativity as we come to think of it in terms of how, you know, many of us think of creativity as a tool that we use to help us make a living, to serve our clients, to advance our career. We're going to talk about the importance of creativity for the sake of creativity. My guest today is Srini Rao. He's the author of a new book called An Audience of One, which is about embracing creativity for its own sake. And those of you who create for a living, like I do, and many of us listening do as well, I think you're going to find this a fascinating conversation. It's hopefully going to help you spark your curiosity again, your wonder again, and reclaim creativity as a means of self-expression, not just as a means of making a living. Before we jump into that, I want to let you know today's episode is brought to you by FreshBooks. So we talk often on the podcast about the importance of having rituals and rhythms in your life to help sustain your creativity over time. The thing is that creating rituals doesn't just apply to your creativity. If you're a freelancer, you're a small business owner, and you don't create rituals around dealing with your paperwork, you're going to have a difficult time sustaining your business. Well, FreshBooks knows this all too well. So well, in fact, that they've created ridiculously easy cloud accounting software that's perfect for creative pros. And the reason I describe it as perfect for creative pros becomes obvious the minute you try it. You can create and send polished professional invoices effortlessly in about 30 seconds. With literally two clicks, you can set yourself up to receive payments online. They've also added a new feature called Proposals that lets you incorporate your project details, your scope of work, and a timeline right into your estimate. We love FreshBooks. Using it makes a huge difference in how we feel about dealing with day-to-day admin and paperwork at Accidental Creative. And right now, FreshBooks is offering an unrestricted 30-day free trial, which means that you don't need a credit card. All you have to do is go to freshbooks.com/accidental and enter accidental in the How Did You Hear About Us section. That's freshbooks.com/accidental and enter accidental in the How Did You Hear About Us section. We thank FreshBooks for sponsoring this episode of the Accidental Creative Podcast. All right, let's jump into the conversation with Srini Rao. Just a quick disclaimer, we had some technical issues recording this episode, issues with Skype. So my voice is going to sound much different than normal, but the content I think is going to resonate and I think you're going to find it really valuable. Hope you enjoy it.
Well, our guest today on the Accidental Creative Podcast is Srini Rao. He's the author of a new book called An Audience of One, Reclaiming Creativity for Its Own Sake. Srini, welcome to the Accidental Creative.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
So you've been on the show before, and we've talked about your work before and your podcast and all the amazing stuff that you do. But for those who may not have heard that episode, would you mind just kind of letting us know a little bit about you and what your work and what you do and kind of what you're into?
Yeah. So the primary thing I'm known for is a podcast called The Unmistakable Creative, where I interview insanely interesting people from all walks of life. They've ranged from bank robbers to drug dealers to performance psychologists to authors to entrepreneurs to billionaires, all of them having this thread of being really fascinating in common. I think that I see myself as an entertainer first and an educator second. So we try to blend sort of a practical and inspiring view into a person's life story, combine their work as well as their personal journey and story to give you this sort of multidimensional portrait of who they are. And one of the byproducts of Unmistakable Creative, which I've now run for almost 10 years, where I've interviewed more than 700 people, was, of course, writing books, being a public speaker. And so I have written another book prior to this, two other books. One was a self-published book called The Art of Being Unmistakable, which became a Wall Street Journal bestseller that led to a book deal with a publisher. Then Unmistakable, Why Only Is Better Than Best, which was what you and I talked about in our previous interview, and now An Audience of One, Reclaiming Creativity for Its Own Sake.
Fantastic. So I'm fascinated by this topic because I know a lot of people who are listening are create on demand professionals, right? These are people who go to work and they have to solve problems for other people. They have to design and write and do whatever it is that it takes for them to deliver value to their clients. And so the idea of creativity for its own sake can seem like kind of a foreign concept, I think, to some people. I mean, at one point in our life, we certainly engaged in it, but now it seems like creativity is a tool in our tool belt that we use to create value. So what is it that made you decide that this was the topic that you wanted to write about with this book?
Well, I think like most books, the topic kind of revealed itself as I continued to write. What's funny about this book is that we didn't even have a title for it until we got to the end of the manuscript. Wow. The whole time the Google Doc basically just said book two or creative practice. But the idea behind this book was that Penguin really wanted to position this as sort of an artist way for the digital era. One thing that's really kind of an interesting byproduct of the fact that we have more tools, technology, resources, and distribution channels than we ever have before to express our creativity is that they've paradoxically inhibited our creativity. Because so often the default narrative in our culture has become, why would I do this thing if a million people aren't listening or if thousands of people aren't paying attention to it? And the desire to express our creativity is often so driven by the desire for validation and attention and, you know, vanity metrics like hearts and likes and followers and fans, all of which really are, in my mind, are not a true measure of the value of creative work. So in that process, we've lost this ability to, claim creativity for its own sake and focus, you know, specifically on the process itself, which is where most of the rewards and most of the joy of creative work actually tend to be found. So a perfect example, you spend, as you know, because we both have the same imprint at Penguin that we're part of, you spend the overwhelming majority of your time on a book actually writing the book and a very small amount of the time in the spotlight talking about the book and sharing it on social media. So if you're only driven by the desire to be in the spotlight, you're setting yourself up for disappointment because that is such a small fraction of where the time is spent. And the thing that happens as a result of that is people figure, okay, well, if I don't have the spotlight, I might as well not try at all. I might as well not do anything. And what's interesting is if you look throughout history, even in the book, we open the stories with David Bowie as well as Daft Punk, people who have prioritized their own happiness and made the craft itself of their work, getting good at their work solely not for their own sake, not for the sake of impressing somebody, have ended up doing much better and much more interesting work that has stayed relevant for multiple decades. I mean, we've seen this with Oprah, we've seen it with Daft Punk, we've seen it with David Bowie. And what's interesting that you'll see, this is something that I noticed as I was doing research for this book, is when I started looking at the people on the internet who had had creative projects that had become wildly successful to the point where they were reaching millions of people. People like Frank Warren, who created Post Secret, people like Maria Popova, who created Brain Pickings, is that almost none of them started with the notion of, I'm going to monetize this in some way, I'm going to reach a million people in some way. It was almost always the result of their desire to express some creative impulse. And what has happened, because of the fact that we have social media, because of the fact that we can be validated, because of the fact that we have courses and tactics and hacks, instead of being driven by the desire to express a creative impulse, people are almost always driven by the desire to get attention in some form or another. And so I'm making an argument for the fact that there is great value to expressing your creativity, even if it's done just for yourself. Because if you think about it, the overwhelming majority of your work is actually done in private. And so this frees you up to not have the pressure to always produce something amazing because you're able to produce as much volume as you want. And paradoxically, this is the thing I said, is that, you know, the ultimate paradox of creative work is that what you create for an audience of one is much more likely to reach an audience of billions. Because you think about the formula, you yourself opened your very first book with this notion of cover bands can't change the world. And if you look at sort of the notion of, oh, I want to reach an audience of millions of people, so I'm going to go and I'm going to do what the person who reaches millions of people has done, that really, at best, you'll become a pale imitation of that person, at worst, completely ignored.
Right. And that's why I love you use the word value. I think, you know, we often ascribe value to how something we create is received versus mm-hmm. its value as a creative expression.
Absolutely.
Or we, as you said, we make bargains with ourselves about why we're doing something, or maybe we even lie to ourselves about our true motivation for doing something. And yeah. really we're trying to get something that we aren't really fully being honest about with our work. I mean, in my early days out of school, I called it my misguided 20s now, but they weren't really misguided. But you know, I was a traveling musician, and we had the chance to open for a lot of really big national acts, as well as some like sort of moderately successful acts who had just kind of broken through. And frankly, some of the most miserable people that we encountered were the acts that had just kind of broken through. Maybe they just had their first couple of hits or something, and they were just realizing that they signed up for something that they didn't want, you know? Mm-hmm. So now it's like, oh, we're successful. Oh, we've got some hits. Oh, people are coming out to see us. And they were doing it because they wanted the attention, the acclaim, all of that kind of, you could just kind of see it, you know, you could hear it just by kind of talking to them. It was never about the music. It was about what came with the music, right? All of the acclaim and all the applause and all of that. But once the thrill of that begins to wear off, they were just miserable, because they didn't really love music. And some of the people that were the happiest, Srini, were the people who had been doing it for, some of them have been doing it for a couple of decades, and it was because they loved the music. They loved being on the road with their friends, making music. It wasn't about the acclaim or the applause. It was about the process of creating on the road. And those are some of the most successful people that we encountered.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, right? Because the thing that I think people often don't realize is that the real reward for being commercially successful with your creative work is that you get to keep doing that work.
Yes.
You know, if you succeed with a book, for example, you get to write more books. It was when my friend Chris Plow asked me when I was at this event recently, what is your goal with books? And I said, to be honest, just to write more books. Mm. That's literally my goal with my books. If they, you know, reach more people, wonderful. I think the thing that it really drives me is the fact that I want to be able to keep doing this more than anything else. And I think that that requires a long-term view. And we live in a world where a long-term view is 1 year, which is ludicrous, because if you think about what truly goes into people who becoming masters of their craft, it is very much a lengthy process. Mostly, more often than not, it's the pursuit of a lifetime if you really want to become world-class at any creative endeavor.
Yeah, for sure. So what was the most interesting story that you uncovered in writing the book of somebody who had embraced creativity for its own sake?
Well, I think that Daft Punk was probably one of my favorite stories. And it's funny because I'm not a Daft Punk diehard fan or anything like that. I just happened to be in Colombia. Like most books, we actually didn't go and we didn't write the introduction until we were done with the book, which that happens for a lot of people who've never gone through this process, because it's hard to write an introduction when you don't know how the book is going to end. And I remember thinking, how do we open this book with the right stories? And I was watching this documentary about Daft Punk with my friend Mike Harrington in Colombia, and had no idea how I was going to, you know, basically open the book. And when I watched that documentary, a number of things stood out to me. The first was that the more famous Daft Punk became, the more anonymous they chose to make themselves. They went out of their way to minimize whatever public exposure they might get. As if anybody has seen Daft Punk perform, even at the Grammys or even at Coachella, they wear masks. So you would not recognize the two members of Daft Punk if you saw them walking down the street. And the other thing that really struck me was that when they signed one of their first record deals with Virgin, they were going out to a dinner with a record company executive, and somebody pulled up in a limousine and they said, "We don't want to be seen going around in a limousine. We'll take the subway. We'll meet you at the restaurant." Mm. And in a world that praises, craves, and puts celebrity on pedestal through social media platforms driven entirely by vanity metrics, that is a really strange choice. It's rare that somebody makes that choice. But what they said is that you don't have to have your picture on the cover of magazines to write great music. Yeah. And I think that to me really stood out. I remember when I was at World Domination Summit, an event that you and I have been at a couple of times, somebody had told me that they had met somebody who listened to The Unmistakable Creative. They said, "I know The Unmistakable Creative. I listen to it all the time. I don't know who Srini is." And I said, "That means we've done our job." That was far more important. I would much rather people know the brand than know who I am.
Sure. Yeah. Well, and what's interesting about the Daft Punk example is they didn't have a PR person following them around taking pictures of, hey, look at me taking the subway. Yeah, like you see that sometimes, right? Where you see like celebrities, oh, they're just like us, you know, and like, right. They have like this perfectly lit photo of them taking the subway kind of thing or whatever. And you know, I think when you fall in love with the process and you fall in love with the art that you're creating or the thing that you're doing, you know, I think that you can live for a long time off of the fuel that gives you, even if it means sustaining yourself by doing something else, right? Like, it is better to spend the time necessary to hone your craft and to be able to create the work that you want to create than to compromise that work by taking work that pays too soon and then becoming, you're jumping on the treadmill and there's a carrot dangling in front of you and you're just going to be running on the treadmill. You have the illusion of progress, but you're never really going to make the kind of progress that you truly crave.
Yeah, that's such a good point, because I was really late to get a book deal given how long ago I started. I started in 2009, and you know, the ongoing joke was I basically tell other people's stories, which is still what I do to this day. And many of them had gotten book deals, and it was 6 years in before I got my opportunity. And I think 2 or 3 years before, I remember talking to this woman named Betsy Rappaport, and she said, "You're not ready." And of course, at that time, I didn't want to hear that. And that was the best thing that ever happened to me, because it gave me 2 more years to work on the craft. I ended up getting a much more lucrative book deal with a publisher that has many people whose work I look up to, like yourself, like Seth Godin, like Simon Sinek. I thought, wow, I get to be among this group of people now because I was willing to be patient and wait it out. But the thing that often I think it never has really come up in any of the conversations that I've had with people is the fact that I was sort of tinkering with expressing my creativity very, very early on, right as soon as we had the ability to share things on the internet, not even social media sharing. I had a friend who started this website where he would have us write in about what we were doing with our summer vacations. And my stories were the most ridiculous antics of my drunken nights in San Francisco in my 20s. And I would just write them in and send them, and people that I went to school with would read them. And that was all in the midst of a job that I hated with a passion. And so I think that often this sort of creative expression can make situations that we find unbearable and intolerable much more enjoyable, just because they give us some relief from something that we hate.
Well, it's part of your portfolio of creating too, right? Like you have your on-demand creating, but you have to have a portfolio of creating that is outside of what you're being paid for or your sort of on-demand creating. And most people think that those people who are known for what they create only create the things that other people see. But the reality is, and I've known many of these people who are known for what they create, they're creating things that you never see. You know, because it's just for them, and you only see a portion of that portfolio of things that they actually end up putting out in public. For sure.
Yeah, I mean, I write for myself. If other people happen to benefit from it, that's a convenient byproduct. And even when I make guest choices on Unmistakable Creative, I will never make a guest choice based on how many downloads I think it will lead to, or you know, how much attention it will get from the audience. I want to serve the audience, but I'm always looking based on my own curiosity and what I think I'm going to be really proud of. Like, I put that first.
So let's say that somebody out there listening right now, they're sitting in an office cubicle and they're maybe designing right now. Somebody right now just like looked up and said, "Wait a minute, you're talking about me." Yes, I am talking about you. I'm actually looking at you right now through the secret camera on your wall. But let's say somebody's sitting in a cubicle designing right now. What would be your advice to them to help them begin embracing the idea of creativity for its own sake?
So I think this is where you really have to think about this through the lens of systems, habits, and processes. I think that anybody who does creative work for a living knows that this is not true. You talk about creativity on demand. To be able to create on demand and to be able to create consistently, you can't have it be something that occurs in a moment of inspiration whenever you feel like it. I think it was James Clear who said, "Your professionals create on a schedule, amateurs create when they feel like it." And I think that more than anything, that idea of a schedule really is what I would encourage people to do regardless of the craft. Every day when you wake up in the morning, if you're a visual artist, you draw for an hour. If you're a writer, you write for an hour, or you write until you reach 1,000 words. I think the other thing that I would add to this is one of the biggest motivators for anybody is visible progress. And this is based on the work of Teresa Amabile, who teaches a course at Harvard on managing for creatives. But it turns out that when we make progress, it increases our motivation. And as a result, the habit is much more likely to stick. So this is why you see people who do things like the don't break the chain calendar, where they mark a number of days in a row and keep trying to get that chain going. And I noticed this even with my meditation habit. In the Calm app, it actually marks how many days you have a streak for. And I think just the fact that I could see that streak, I'm constantly trying to get a bigger streak. I think the most I've gotten to is 60 something days in a row where I've stopped. But it's interesting because I see that and it motivates me to keep doing it. When I can measure the quantity of my work in terms of words, I keep coming back saying, okay, wait a minute, I hit the goal. I managed to write. And this is one other thing I would say is that I think that you should have some sort of number tied to whatever it is that you're trying to do, even if it is for your own sake. That's because clarity basically accelerates your progress towards a goal. But not only that, it creates a lot of flow, because that's one of the things that Stephen Kotler has found in his own research of the 9 flow triggers. One of them was clear goals. And most of us don't have clear goals. So for example, you might say, okay, write when I wake up in the morning. That's not a very clear goal. That could mean anything. You could write a status update. You could write a tweet. But if you say the goal is to write 1,000 words or write 3 paragraphs, there's no argument of whether or not you hit that goal. You either hit it or you didn't. So the simple act of putting a number in front of something like that amplifies the clarity dramatically.
And to your point, you know, those even putting a reasonable number, right, mm-hmm. in front of yeah. it and making sure it's something that's sustainable. But once you begin Absolutely. To do that, it's amazing how much progress you make over time. If you put a reasonable, you know, I used to strive to write 1,000 words a day on my books. And I realized that there were some days I was really straining to write 1,000 mm-hmm. words, and I would feel bad because I'd write like 850 words and I would feel miserable at the end of the day. And I realized like, wait a minute, why am I doing this? I have a year to write this book. I could do this with 500 words a day and I can Absolutely. Do that easily and I can feel good about it. At the end of the day, maybe I'll get to 520 or something. Although uh-huh. near the end, I started cutting off at 500. I would like literally in the middle of a sentence say, I'm done, I'm finished, and I'll pick up right there tomorrow. But it's funny how, you know, all of a sudden now in a week, you've got like half a chapter. In 2 weeks, you've got a chapter, you know, in a month, you've got 2 chapters. You know, it's like funny Absolutely. How things add up very quickly when you
Exactly.
do that.
People underestimate the impact of small, consistent actions. The reason that works so well is the fact that you're staying in motion, and motion creates momentum, and momentum results in progress. And so you get this virtuous cycle of motivation, momentum, and progress and habit maintenance. So yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, there are days when I don't hit the 1,000 words, and absolutely, I think people should start with something that is manageable, that is sustainable. And given that you're going to write 500 words every day, it doesn't matter if today was any good. If today was awful, you know you'll be back tomorrow. So my ongoing joke when people ask about my writing process is I say that I very rarely write anything worth reading. I just write a lot.
Yeah. So, yeah.
But yeah, that's absolutely, I think, essential to increasing your creative output is having a systematized approach to it that you repeat on a regular basis.
Fantastic. Well, my guest has been Srini Rao, author of An Audience of One, Reclaiming Creativity for Its Own Sake, host of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, which if you don't listen, you need to go check it out. Srini, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
And as always, thank you for listening. If you like every episode delivered as it's released, just subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts or visit accidentalcreative.com/subscribe. Remember, friends, cover bands don't change the world. Don't be a cover band. You need to find your unique voice if you want to thrive. We'll see you next time.